Let me open with a word of prayer and we'll get started here. Father, you're gracious. And we are very, very thankful for that. As Steve expressed a moment ago, and I share in that sentiment, we feel utterly unworthy in and of ourselves to stand here and proclaim your word and worship you or any of the rest of it. And yet that's what you call us to do, and we praise you that you have given us this privilege. Father, I just pray that as I stand here this morning and proclaim your word, that I would proclaim it accurately, that I would feed your lambs as you have instructed us to do, that I would do so faithfully, that I would do so in the power of the Spirit, and that you would be at work in our hearts as we listen to the word preached, and that you would be at work in our hearts this week as we go away from a gathering place of your people and continue to carry out the things which we have seen in the Word, and that we would do so faithfully. It is only by your power that we can do so. We thank you for these things. In Jesus' name, amen. We are continuing today in a series of lessons. I anticipate this will be the last time for me to cover this material. We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We have already covered the first section where we see that Paul uses three extraordinary examples to teach us that love is the essential ingredient in the Christian way of life. And we're talking here about agape love that elevates the other person, that love that is given to all, whether that person is worthy or not of such love. This love is given to all, just like Christ's love is given to us who are unworthy as well. Then in the second approach, and this is where we have been spending some time, and we will continue in this section this morning if we finish it up, Paul gives us 15 practical examples that teach us how love behaves. And these are extremely practical, and it has been worth our while, I believe, to slow down and look at each of these and analyze some of them and to contemplate examples of what that might look like in our own lives in a modern setting. And we hope to continue to do that this morning. I just throw out a question you don't feel like you're obligated to answer, but how are we doing with these 15 items? We haven't gotten through all 15 yet, but we have had many practical examples. How are we doing? Are we seeing examples of these things in our lives? I hope that you are. I suspect very much that you are, knowing this group. Are we seeing examples in our lives where these things could increase? If you're like me, you are. And by the way, I know it's the occupational hazard of preaching for someone sitting out there in the audience to think, he's talking about me. And I just want you to know that I actually do have one person specifically in mind as I preach this material. Me. Okay? So if it applies to you, that's by the grace of God, okay? But I really don't, for the most part, the illustrations that I have given you have been borrowed from past other church experiences. I haven't really, I don't think, drawn any illustrations even from my current church, just to kind of keep it enough at a distance that somebody doesn't feel like they're personally being put on the spot or being hung out in public. So again, if you hear an illustration and it seems to fit, you know what they say, if the shoe fits, wear it. But that would be, again, the grace of God opening up something for you. And I hope, of course, that does indeed happen. But don't think it's because I was spying on you, or if I know you and you know that I happen to see an example where you did something like this, I'm probably not thinking of that example at the time. So I just say that to put you at ease. I don't want anybody to feel on the spot. We feel enough conviction, or at least I do, just hearing the word and applying these things to our own lives. I sometimes feel, I hope you won't consider this an inappropriate comment, but I sometimes feel almost naked as I have the word of God open me up, so to speak, and I'm reading this material. It's that embarrassing for me, because I see how much I fall short. And yet, at the same time, I want to say I am encouraged. I'm encouraged to see these things present in my life, and I'm encouraged to see them growing in my life, even since I've just been going through this material. These words of God are echoing in my soul as I encounter tribulations and trials. And the small tribulations and trials that I face in my life, I don't really face all that much, to be honest. But even in those small things, sometimes those are the things that are hardest to be faithful in, are the small things. You'll notice that I have used somewhat simple, ordinary examples. I could give extraordinary examples, but I'd be afraid that people would listen to that and think, well, yeah, I'm not way out there. So I've tried to use examples of things that may tempt each of us. So let's get back into it. We'll just review briefly by reading over the section that we've already covered, making a few comments, and then we'll delve into more depth. We see that love waits patiently, and you will recall that with that, I especially encouraged you to think about those with whom it is most difficult to be patient, and that is those who are there around us all the time, our families. We're there in the morning, we're there in the evening. You remember that example. But it's really not easy to be patient with anyone. I have difficulty being patient with a stranger that I never met who pulls in front of me on the highway. Maybe I have more difficulty with that than even my own family, if it were possible. This is a place where the Word of God becomes immensely practical, that we consider the fact that timing is very important in a Christian life. You remember we talked about that, and how when someone behaves in a certain manner, before we just move in and start to attack, so to speak, or try to correct, it may be time to do that. You may decide that that's best for you to do, but consider that perhaps it may be best to wait. We see things going on around us all the time, and if we were to attack everything that we saw that was a problem, we would be like Don Quixote charging at the proverbial windmills. And we don't want to do that, and we don't certainly want to come across as those who are intolerant and those who are impatient. We should show kindness to others, because love shows kindness, and again, in the family, that's especially appropriate. It's very easy for us to become snippy and snotty and sharp with those who are just simply used to us being that way around them. Sad to say, sometimes, you know, early in the morning, and we make some excuse like I haven't had my coffee yet or something. But these aren't really valid reasons for us to behave in this manner. We may feel like they excuse us, but they do not. And really, such behavior brings a curse upon us and robs us and others around us of the blessing that comes with loving others. And I hope you see it in that way. Love does not burn with envy. And we talked about that and how there's a tendency for us to look at other people. You know, you look at somebody who got something you always wanted and you're mad because you didn't get it. Or because you look at them and they don't seem to be appreciating it as much as you would have appreciated if you had gotten it. And besides, they're not worth it anyways. And so you start going through these mental gymnastics. And then sometimes you may even find yourself sort of responding in some way to that person that's kind of like you're punishing them for having benefited. Why do we do things like that? Rather, when we see others benefit from something, even if it's something that we hunger and long for legitimately ourselves, we should rejoice that they've received that benefit. And we should be the first to congratulate them. I had a situation one time where I was a supervisor over a small group of people in the Little Rock School District long ago. It's been several years now. And some things took place politically, and my boss, who was the director of the entire department, I think moved on to another place, and they were looking for somebody to promote into that position. And I was very obviously the next logical choice to be promoted into that position. Everybody thought that I would get it. Everybody thought I was the natural person to sort of slide into that role. For various political reasons, which I will not detail here because it's not important to the point, I was not selected for that position. But another individual who worked for me as just an ordinary programmer, had no management experience whatsoever, was promoted into that position. And this individual was a person, a very nice young man, a good friend of mine. He worked for me, and I loved him. People who work for me have normally gotten along quite well with the folks who work with me, and he was no exception. And when he heard that he was promoted, he was so embarrassed because he felt like I was going to be angry with him or in some way retaliate against him or something. And so I remember that it's kind of a key moment when I walk into the room, the announcement had been made, and he was sitting at his desk, and I walked over, and he literally, his head was hung down. He could not look at me. And I felt such pity for him. There was no reason for him to feel that way. He was a good man. He was every bit as worthy of that promotion as I was. And he was the one that was selected by the powers that be. And God was happy for that to be the case. I ran across the room, grabbed his hand, and shook it, and congratulated him and hugged him. He was just, totally shocked, But it really, you could see it. I mean, it took a second for it to come over him, but it was just like he was filled with life all of a sudden. And last time I checked, he is still the director of that department, by the way, and he's done an excellent job. He's a fine man. And I am still very, very thankful that he received that promotion. Okay? So, again, we have many temptations in our life, and that's one of the rare ones that I could give you an example where I think I did the right thing. Most of the time, I probably give you examples of how not to do things up here. But there was one that is an opportunity. We have these opportunities all the time. They're small, they're large. Look for them. It's great to be able to do that. And really, this is the thing I hope you see. It's not like, I think in our own minds, we lie to ourselves and we feel like we're making a sacrifice when we treat others with love or we're responding that way. We're having to be nice when we really want to be nasty and punish them. Do we benefit from being nasty and punishing people by our behavior? Not at all. Jealousy is an acid that eats our soul. We destroy ourselves. We become the victim of our own punishment. Oh, indeed, we may make the other person feel bad, and somehow we may have a little bit of a lift from that in our own distorted way. But ultimately, we are destroying ourselves and destroying others around us. Why would we want to do that when there is such blessing? You don't think it was a blessing in that situation for me to be able to congratulate that individual? Was that a sacrifice on my part? Not at all. Not at all. I feel good about it to this day. And that's how we should look at these things. I feel good not only about my response, that I had the presence of mind for once to actually do the right thing, but the fact that he did get that promotion. I still feel good about that. On his behalf. We're blessed by these things. Think of it in that way. Don't think of it as a sacrifice. We have all this self-talk where we convince ourselves that, we're going to make ourselves do it. It's hard. And I know there's a certain struggle with all this. I'm not oblivious to that. But think of it as a positive. Think of it as a blessing. The Scriptures certainly portray it in that manner. And therefore, we should adjust our viewpoint to adopt that perspective. All right, some other things that we looked at. Not inflated with its own importance. We talked about how this is like it's a word actually in the Greek. It was taken from the bellows that they used to use to stoke the fire. In the old days, it made a foosh sound, and that's what the actual Greek word sounds like. And this is saying, don't get puffed up with yourself. I think that goes without any further explanation. We saw in verse 5, that love does not behave with ill-mannered impropriety. And I guess that's a $50 word. We could say do not behave in a rude manner. I think rudeness is the term that's used in the NIV. That's good. I'm not sure it's broad enough, but it's good. It covers a certain amount of ground. Doing things that are inappropriate would be another idea that we want to think about. What this does is this tells us that when love is working in our hearts, we are aware of others. We are aware of our environment. We are aware of our culture. And that might be the culture at large, America, United States, the West, whatever. Or it might be the specific culture of your workplace or your church or your home. And within any culture or any environment, there are things that are considered normal, appropriate, acceptable, and so forth. And there are things that would be shocking, rude, offensive, and in many cases rightfully so. We want to, as much as we can, and still staying within the boundaries of scriptural guidelines, obviously, be behave in a manner that's appropriate, behave in a manner that's not needlessly shocking or rude or inconsiderate of those around us. Always being aware of those things. Always being aware. This takes an awareness. This takes studying other people, understanding what makes other people tick. Sometimes it comes down to even what's appropriate for a specific individual. You may remember I quoted at one point, I think, from Paul in Thessalonians. He talked about encouraging those who were timid. Remember? Well, you wouldn't necessarily take the same approach with a timid person that you would with somebody who was brash and who needed correcting. You have to adjust your behavior to be appropriate for particular individuals. Many applications. This is a very broad principle, and it's very helpful to us. And again, we're blessed as we consider these things, and those around us are blessed by this. Not preoccupied with the interest of self. That goes back to the definition of love to begin with. Agape love is putting others above yourself. Does not become exasperated into pique, and that word really has the idea of irritation or anger. So I put that in brackets. I'm borrowing somebody else's translation. I thought they used too big of a $50 word there, so I like the idea of not exasperated into irritation or anger. And you may remember that we talked about last time how this may be someone who actually does, in fact, stimulate on purpose irritation or anger. And yet, we are still called to not become exasperated with that kind of person. Now, quite honestly, there are times when others appear to us to be purposely exasperating us, but they're not, at least not intentionally. They may, in actuality, be irritating us or causing us, you know, to respond in anger, and we think they're just doing that just to push my buttons, is the phrase I think we use, right? And boy, nothing makes me madder when somebody tries to push my buttons, you know, and then you start responding in anger. Again, you brought out the acid. You're eating away at your soul. You're not helping the situation. What do the scriptures teach us? Respond to evil and overcome evil with good. That's how we respond. Now, that's not to say we don't correct, that we don't rebuke. At times, there's a place for that, biblically speaking. But again, it would be with gentleness. It would be with appropriateness to the situation and the person. And we're not as easily stirred to these things. We're slow to anger. That is the ideal. Again, I have to go back to the, because it's such a common example with me, perhaps many of you, traffic. Maybe it's because I live in a city, I don't know. But, I can just become convinced somebody that just cut in front of me and driving slow is just doing it to irritate me, you know. And I get all worked up about this, and then I catch myself, you know. And what am I doing? You know, that person doesn't even know me. He doesn't even have any idea I'm having that reaction. But the Lord sees my reaction. Is he pleased with it? Not at all. Does it help anything, even in any sense of the word? Not at all. You may say, well, it makes me feel better. I get it off my chest. I would say to you, you may think it makes you feel better and you're getting it off your chest to borrow that buzzword, but I would suggest to you that you're actually destroying your own soul in one sense. You are hurting yourself. It may have a good feel to it in some sense, but the scriptures tell us you are sinning, you are hurting yourself, you are doing violence and damage to yourself. It serves no purpose. It serves evil purpose. So bear those things in mind. Then in verse 6, we saw a sort of a contrasting idea. Love does not take pleasure at wrongdoing, but joyfully celebrates the truth. And we analyzed this and realized that there were some possibilities as far as the language, but we came down on the idea that what this means is when we love other people, we are excited when others succeed. And we don't take pleasure in the fact when somebody does something wrong. There's a tendency, even in, maybe even especially in Christian circles, when somebody does something wrong, there's that insidious pleasure, although it sounds warped when you analyze it this way, and it is, that we get by watching somebody fail, and we get to go over and correct them, say, hey, you know, and make an issue out of it, okay? Again, we're not saying you shouldn't correct people with a spirit of love, but be careful about the heart. Be careful your attitude is not someone who feels good about somebody else failing so you, the great Pharisee, can go over and make a big correction. Instead, you're grieved. You want to help. You want to come alongside. You want to do what you can to help that person to understand what they need to do differently or to help pick them up. They may already know they're stumbling and falling. Help them. And you rejoice in the truth. When you see the truth being carried out and practiced by those around you, you're excited about that. So that brings us to verse 7. And we have just a brief introduction to this verse. There's a quartet or four different statements about love made in verse 7. And your traditional translation will say something like, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And I want to say that's somewhat misleading. I don't think that's the idea that was intended when Paul expressed this. Because let's, for example, particularly the idea of believes all things, what on earth would that mean? So I believe in Christianity and I believe in the Muslim religion and I believe in atheism and I just believe everything. I believe all things. I don't think that's what Paul would be advocating. I haven't met too many people. I did actually meet one lady one time that she was trying to sell us some really odd product, and she was kind of an odd lady, actually. And we were talking to her about Christianity. The subject came up. We were trying to witness to her, and she said, yep, I believe all that. She said, I'm a believer. And what she meant by that term, she just believes everything. Like, strange. No, that's not what Paul is advocating now, okay? That's not it at all. The NIV avoids this problem and conveys what is more likely the true sense of the original. I like what it does. It says, love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. So it's not when we, it's not that we're believing. The word all is there, but you misapply it when you apply it to the thing, believe all things. It should be always believing. Okay, we still got to explain that, but I think that's where the direction should go. All right, let's take a look at this now with that in mind as sort of a background. The first one is, this is one of those cases where, and there haven't been too many of these. In fact, I think it's maybe the first one, it may be the only actually in the entire list, where sometimes we come across a word in the New Testament and we don't have a way of getting a real strong handle on what it means. Now, there are ways to approach this as a preacher. A good way to approach this for many preachers, and I've done this myself, you look at the possibilities, you figure out which one you think is best, and you run with that, and you preach it. Okay? I could do that here. I have opted, in this case, to reveal to you that there's somewhat of a toss-up of meaning with this word. Why do I take the time to do that in this one instance? I do that so that you become aware that there are those cases. There are times when we have to struggle with the meaning of words. It takes study. It takes going back through materials. Of course, scholars have done much of this work for us. We ought to be very thankful for the amount of work that has been done for us by scholars in this area. And it's really rather rare we come across a verse where there's even this much doubt. The good news is, most of the time, even when there's doubt, whichever way you go, you're going to get a good application out of it. And I would think that's the case here. The word used here is a word that's very similar to the word for a roof. Or in some places in the country, they say roof. I always call it a roof. I don't know where you stand on that scale. The same word is used for a roof. In fact, in Mark chapter 2, verse 4, I think that's the one where they're burrowing through the roof. And that's the Greek word. It's used very, very similar. You can see stego, stege. And so there's the idea of a roof involved here. And this could mean, I looked up the various folks who have made a venture as to what this might, venture to guess as to what this means. It could mean to cover, like a roof covers a house. And so in this case, it would be always covers. Bagdi, which is a very well-known lexicon for those who do any amount of study. You may see those letters. Their idea was that it means cover, and they say love throws a cloak of silence over what is displeasing in another person. I think that's a valid application. Is that exactly what the writer had in mind here? I'm not sure. But I would tend to go with this personally. If I were going to pick one and not tell you that it had possible meanings, I would probably just go with that one. I wouldn't do what Thistleton did in this case. It could also mean to bear, and in the sense of put up with. Like a roof bears a snow load or bears a certain amount of burden or protection or whatever. It could be that idea. The problem is that there's another word in this quartet at the very end that it's a hupomeno that means basically the same thing. So you would have Paul saying the same thing at the beginning and end of four items, and that tends to be sort of unlikely, so we tend to throw that one out. It carries the idea it could carry the idea of protect. A roof protects you from the weather, from the elements. The NIV went with that. I think that's very valid. It's very close to cover, really. And it could be the idea of support, which is what Thistleton went with. I would go, personally, again, with the idea of cover. And I think there's a valid principle there that we could gather from other texts of Scripture. One was brought to my attention last week. Love covers a multitude of sins. And this type of idea, and I don't want to try to develop that fully, but I think the idea I would see there, we're not saying that you ignore sin. Obviously, Scripture says if there is clear sin, you must go to that person and try to work through that with the individual. We're not bypassing that process that the Scriptures teach us. We're not saying that if a person has a very serious problem that you just hide your head in the sand and don't try to help that person. Or even in some cases, if a problem is serious enough, you might need to report that person to the authorities, honestly, depending on the circumstance. So we're not saying that you just overlook things that are serious in nature. But what we are saying is, you know, all of us fail in many ways. All of us have annoying and irritating habits that may probably are based in sin, though we don't always know if it's just that or if it's our perceived irritation. But whatever the case may be, you roll with that. You don't make an issue out of that. You're not always picking and poking at other people. That becomes an irritant to other people, and it's not loving. And I hear this so many times. Again, family situations keep coming to my mind. It's shocking to me how many times I hear family members say in front of other family members ugly things about those folks. I may be over the house visiting, and again, if this has happened with me and you hear, I'm not thinking of you. Okay, I don't remember that it has, but I'll be over someone's house and they'll point to their son or daughter and say, you know, Johnny's just, that kid, I don't know what I'm going to do with him. He's just a huge problem. I'm just fed up with him. He's so disobedient, and I'm just tired of him. And Johnny's sitting over there hearing this, and I'm thinking, you know, even if that's true, I don't think I would be announcing that in front of Johnny. I don't think that's helpful, personally. I've heard husbands and wives do this. A wife will complain, well, you know, my husband, he's always, you know. Now, I realize there's a place for where there's a concern in a marriage relationship to deal with that, either between the spouses or maybe even go to some other mature Christian who can counsel you in those areas, and you have to share those things. Please don't hear a criticism of that at all. But just sort of a general complaining nature or a general just constantly nipping at and picking at the other person, let's try to avoid that. That's not loving. We don't like that when people do that to us. And that would be true in any environment. I pick on the home again because it's so prevalent. Love never loses faith. What does that mean? Well, we have some great experts that we can call on here who have some things to weigh in on, have some things with which to weigh in on. Hodge says, it is not suspicious, it readily credits what men say in their own defense. Now, here's the key idea here. And that is that we try as much as possible to give others the benefit of the doubt, as much as possible. Now, at the same time, I have a quotation here from good old John Calvin who says, not that a Christian strips himself of wisdom and discernment, not that he has forgotten how to distinguish black from white, right? We don't have to be fools. We can look at somebody and recognize they may have evil motive in what they're doing. I like to think about the example where Jesus sent out the disciples and he said to them, he says, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves. Now, we all know what wolves do to sheep, right? And so Jesus said, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves. He says, be as wise as serpents and be as innocent as doves. That's what we need to be. We need to be balanced. wise as serpents. We're not fooled. We can see. We're not blind. We see when others are trying to pull the wool over our eyes. We watch things that are going on. If we see a pattern or a serious issue arising, we address that appropriately. But at the same time, many times others are doing things and we're assuming ill of them. We should always assume the best we can of other people. Always. And sometimes it's hard to do. My wife and I get into this sometimes, you know, and she said, I saw that look on your face. I know what you meant by what you said. And honestly, I know what I meant because I was in my head, and that was not what I meant. I may have had a horrible face on. I'll have to learn not to make that face. But whatever it is, the best I know my own heart, I was not thinking what she thought I meant. Okay? We do this to one another at times, and I'm sure I understand why you can become convinced somebody's thinking something, a particular look on their face. But we have to give others the benefit of the doubt, believing the best about all people, as Augustine says. Love never exhausts hope. We hope for the best in regard to all men. We hope things work out for others to the best. And we've already covered this idea in some of the other issues. And then love never gives up. This is the last one. It's a military word, and it means it's like to sustain an assault. The world is assaulting us. At times we feel like our own families are assaulting us. All right? You need to sustain the assault and continue to stand up. What does that mean? It means you continue to respond in love. You continue to respond as you ought to and not as your flesh would tempt you to, not as you would naturally tend to go, not as has been your habit perhaps. So there we have the final item of our list. I wanted to just say a few things about this list as a whole. Because I look at this and I think, what do you do with a list like this? You read through this and you just, if you're like me, you feel your life coming apart, you know, bit by bit as you see places where you're failing. How do we handle this? Well, let me begin with just a few general words of advice, because I really would not want to have spent this much time in all this material, have you listen for this much time to all this material, and have you go away with minimal benefit. That could happen. One way that could happen would be to do what James advises us not to do, and I just put some advice from the book of James here. It reads clearly for itself. James said, do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like a man who looks at his face in the mirror and after looking at himself goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But the man who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom, and that's what we've been looking into. We've been looking into Christ's law, the perfect law. It gives freedom. You hear that? It gives freedom. And continues to do this, not forgetting what he has heard, but doing it, he will be blessed in what he does. I encourage you to continue to keep these things in your mind. Post them on your refrigerator if that helps you. Go back and read it every so often if that helps you. Keep the main idea in mind. The other-centeredness will cover all bases quite well, and that's not hard to memorize or remember. And don't go away and forget. As you were sitting here in this audience, I've encouraged you to think about examples where you may have fallen short. If you did that and you thought of things, don't leave this room and then whoop, just forget about it and go on about your life like you always have. And please don't excuse yourself on that basis. Say, well, you know, I've been this way for X number of years, and I guess I'm not going to change now. I'm just impossible. God can change you. And you will be blessed when he changes you. Look what it says. In doing this, he will be blessed. The person who looks at these things and sees where he needs to change and does it, you'll be blessed. This is not something where you punish yourself, you know, in some way. No. We're seeking blessing here. We're looking for something that's great. That's what we want to see. All right. Well, that's just some ideas that we could spend more time on that, but I want to go ahead and complete Paul's teaching in this area. We have a section that's actually a larger section of what we've covered thus far, but it's not near as practical, so I'm hoping we can get through it in fairly short order. This is the hardest part about this is just the number of things that Paul says that seem to kind of jar your mind. Love never fails. Where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. Okay? For we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. You're going, okay. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish things behind me. Now we see, but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall fully know, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. The greatest of these is love. Well, let me just go through and tell you what I think, in essence, Paul is saying. There are many things here that just sort of bring questions to my mind the first time I read this. When perfection comes, what's that? Knowledge will cease. We're not going to know things. What does that mean? Face to face, what's that talking about? And you kind of maybe have ideas. Let me lay it out for you in summary fashion, and you know, you can look back over this. In this third approach, Paul teaches, remember there are three approaches, the one where he teaches that love is essential, the second where he gives practical examples. Third approach, Paul teaches the superiority of love over all other Christian gifts and virtues. Verses 8 through 10, I think what he's saying in those verses is love is eternal. The gifts are temporal. Then he gives two illustrations demonstrating the superiority of the eternal state over the present. And in the last statement, he says of the three eternal virtues, three of Paul's favorites, faith, hope, and love, he uses those three all the time. Love is the greatest of those three. So that's in essence where Paul's going. There's no doubt about where he ultimately is going. There's maybe a few questions along the road. I will try to answer those to the best of my ability, and you can consider those. Love is eternal. The gifts are temporal. He gives three gifts here. He says, love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Tongues, they will be stilled. Knowledge, it will pass away. We've talked about prophecy. We've talked about tongues. Knowledge, I don't think it's just like any knowledge in your head. I think he probably has reference to the gift of knowledge or the word of knowledge he referred to in the previous chapter, chapter 12. And it had to do with a special revelation or a knowledge given by God, I believe. And what he's basically saying is when we get to heaven, we're not going to need all these spiritual gifts. We're not going to need to be prophesying. We're not going to need to be speaking in tongues. We're not going to need special revelation. We're going to be right there with God. It'll be revelation, period. And so he's just simply pointing out, when we get to heaven, we don't need the gift, but we'll still be loving one another. We'll still be loving God. Love just continues on. So get used to loving, folks. We're going to be doing it forever. All right? You may have some spiritual gifts, and you may do all kinds of stuff around the church or whatever you do. But you won't be doing that in heaven, but you'll be loving others in heaven. And that's what Paul's point is. Love is eternal. And so that makes it superior because it lasts longer. And he gives two illustrations, I guess as though we needed it, to show that the eternal state is superior to our present state. The eternal state is when we get to heaven. The present state is where we are now on earth. Okay? And he uses the example of a child, and he uses the example of a mirror. His first example, he basically says, we're like children now. You know how a child can understand things to a certain point? But they, you know, the illustration Hodge uses here, a child may look up at the heavens and see the stars and the moon and all that sort of thing and have an impression and be taught certain things. But a child doesn't begin to have the understanding that an astronomer would have, for example. Okay? And that's the way it is now. The things we understand now about God and an eternal state and all that sort of thing, it's just not even hardly a drop in the bucket. It's true as far as it goes. Perhaps not, but it doesn't compare. So the eternal state is obviously far better. Therefore, the state where love carries on shows the superiority of love. That's his point. And he uses an illustration with a mirror, and with some historical research, there's the thinking that, and you can show this, that in the ancient world around or prior to this time, the mirror was used as an illustration of indirect knowledge. In other words, instead of looking at reality, you can hold up a mirror and look at it in the mirror. You're seeing it, but you're not seeing it directly, you see? And so that's the idea. We see things in eternity, but it might not be as clear. It might not be exactly what it's going to be. In fact, we know it won't. So again, the eternal state is obviously superior, so therefore love is superior. That's the point you want to get out of all that. And then he gives the three eternal virtues, faith, hope, and love. All of these carry into eternity, Paul says. And I know some people have difficulty with this. They say, well, why are we going to need faith in heaven? Because we have a passage like in 2 Corinthians 5:7, we live by faith, not by sight. Well, we'll be by sight then, won't we? Why would we need faith? Well, our faith then will be of a different nature than it is now. It will be by sight, surely, but we will still have trust in God, will we not? We will still be trusting Him for all the ages. It continues. Hope. And, you know, Romans 8 talks about hope it is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has? And they say, see, we can't have hope in eternity. We already have it then. Well, yes, in one sense, but hope will look different in heaven. Hope is that confident expectation, is what the word literally means. And are we not going to continue to have confident expectation of what God will continue to present to us throughout the ages? Absolutely. It just will look different. So these things, there's not much difficulty if you put thought to it. And we will love God and love one another. And Paul's saying, of those three, love is the greatest. This is the supreme virtue. And so that just sort of puts the capstone on this whole passage and brings it all together. Again, he comes back full circle around to his original point, which is the superiority and essential nature of love. It's eternal. It's better than anything. Better than all the gifts and all the rest of it. All right. Well, there you have it. Those are the way that Paul approaches this issue. I hope that this has been helpful to you. I had a song I was going to do, but I think I'm going to pass on that at the moment because we're a little bit out of time here. Well, all right. Hang on here. We'll have to bring it up for you. Apologize. I just get carried away talking up here and don't sometimes get everything done that I hope to get done. Okay. And I have asked Tony if he would come up and move the screen because the screen changes twice for this song. Just to give you a little bit of background, all you do, Tony, you just kind of stand over here and just click on the left side of the mountain whenever I get to the end of that section. The reason I chose this song, you may say, what does this have to do with 1 Corinthians 13? I think it has everything to do with 1 Corinthians 13. And what I mean is this. What ultimately is the thing that motivates us to love? What is our highest example of love? It's Jesus Christ and what He's done for us. And so when we look at that example, when you're in your prayer time and you're confessing the things that you're doing wrong, your shortcomings in this list, and you're struggling with this, one of the things that I really want to encourage you to turn to is think again. Go back to the beginning. What drew you into the Christian life? What is it that makes it possible for you to have good standing with God? It was that sacrifice on the part of Jesus Christ. It was the love that Jesus Christ showed us. And that's what the song's about. It's about the love that He showed us. The song that's done by the Martins, and I have it attributed on the bottom. I guess you can't see it as well as I would like up there. My selection of colors is not good, but hopefully you can, between my pronunciation and your reading, you might be able to see it, hear it all. Blessed Redeemer, Lord of my life, Lord of all mercy, healed by His stripes. All torn and tattered, beaten and bruised, a tortuous ending, yet He remained true. He remained true. A love beyond measure, which words can't explain. A holy life lived for heavenly gain. Flesh put asunder, doing God's will. Sweet love demonstrated, the world could not kill. The world could not kill. And the nails through His hands didn't hold my Lord down. And the nails through His feet mattered not. No, the spear in His side would have never been thrust had it not been for the love. Thank You, Lord Jesus, through worship and praise. I love You dearly, for of my day. That's what I owe you for all of your pain, for giving your life, Lord, so I could be saved, so I could be saved. And the nails to his hands didn't hold my Lord down, and the nails to his feet mattered not. No, the spear through his side would have never been thrust had it not been for the love. No, the thorns for a crown would have never been placed, for the robe would have never cast lot. They would never have been made a spectacle of had it not been for the love. For the love. I love you dearly for all of my days. Amen.